This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the show. I'm Lee Chui Lin. The malaria parasite grows ever more resistant to drugs, just as the mosquitoes that carry them have become resistant to the insecticides that should kill them off. The war on malaria is ongoing, drawn out, and its face keeps changing. However, a recent breakthrough in research may give us hope. Professor Brendan Crabb, microbiologist and one of the researchers involved in this, provides some detail. Professor Crabb, could you give us a brief recap on why malaria has been so difficult to treat?
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. Look, you're absolutely right that malaria is becoming resistant parasite to the available drugs, and there actually have been some very good drugs over the last 50 or 60 years, many of them, and best known being chloroquine, of course, and all sorts of derivatives that drug that many of your listeners would be aware of. But the parasite has a capacity to mutate in response to those drugs and therefore change in a way that allows the parasite to grow in the presence of those drugs. So the world is now on its last effective anti-malarial drug, compound known as artemisinin, and there's widespread resistance to all of the others. So time is sort of running out, and with malaria being still probably the world's most important infectious disease, you know, along with perhaps HIV and tuberculosis, it's still that significant despite all the progress that's been made. We really have to find new drugs and, of course, insecticides, as you also mentioned, to deal with this problem.
What is the process of infection when it comes to malaria? How does it infect our bodies?
It infects our bodies via mosquitoes, of course, and as people know, you get malaria from mosquitoes. It's, of course, not the mosquito that causes the malaria. It's a microscopic parasite, smaller than one of our own cells, that lives normally inside our red blood cells and gets taken up by a particular sort of mosquito, an Anopheles mosquito, when that mosquito feeds on a human. And it grows within that mosquito, a female Anopheles mosquito, very effectively. And then she, when she bites another person, transmits that malaria to somebody who was uninfected. So it's sort of, malaria has this human-mosquito-human life cycle. And it needs both hosts, the mosquito host and the human host, to complete its life cycle. And that's why interfering with the parasite in people through drugs works, and also why interfering with the mosquito through insecticides or bed nets or some process to kill or avoid getting bitten also works.
So really what we're attempting to do, I guess, is to interrupt the cycle on either side of the divide.
Yeah, that's right. And it's an ongoing challenge to find new drugs. This is not unique to malaria. Every infection that humans have to deal with have this problem of resistance, and so we're always trying to find new antibiotics, or in this case, new antimalarials that get around that resistance mechanism. And it can be, yes, either targeting the form in the human host or in the mosquito.
So why are host red blood cells such ideal places for malaria parasites to infect?
That's a very good question. Look, they are a very safe home for the parasite. When the parasite is released into the bloodstream, within a minute or so, it gets inside a red blood cell and then lives there for the best part of 2 days, where it grows and replicates to become 10 or 20 more parasites. They burst out and within a minute or so invade new red blood cells. And what that tells you is they want to live most of their life inside a red blood cell because it's firstly a safe home. The parasite is not exposed to the hostilities of our own immune system, which would quickly recognize them. They're in this safe home. And also because the red blood cell is full of food, full of protein in particular, in the form of hemoglobin, that the parasite wants to eat so it can grow. So it loves being inside a red blood cell, and it's turned out to be a very successful strategy for its survival.
Looking at the treatment available today, what factors would determine a patient's course of treatment?
Well, the key factor as to whether the person can be treated or not relates to the parasite, not so much the person. You know, so if the strain of parasite that they have, malaria is caused by two particular species of parasite, largely Plasmodium falciparum and Plasmodium vivax. And it depends on what strain people have. But as I say, most strains of P. falciparum, Plasmodium falciparum, which is the virulent form of the parasite, the most virulent form of the parasite, most strains are resistant to all antimalarial drugs now. So you can simply make the assumption that you need to treat with a regime that has this artemisinin in it, this only effective compound, perhaps in combination, or definitely in combination with other drugs, even though they're less effective. So it's really, treatment has not so much to do with the patient, but with the genetic strain of the parasite that's infecting them.
And you mentioned artemisinin again, and that, as you say, is sort of the last remaining bastion of efficacy against malaria. What causes malaria strains to grow drug resistant? What's the process of that?
Well, every time a genome is copied, so I mentioned a parasite inside a red blood cell becomes 10 new parasites or 20 new parasites. When that happens, its genome has to be copied. Now, when any genome gets copied, there are errors introduced into that genetic code. Now, normally those errors are benign, and we never see them, no matter what the organism is. But in the face of a selective force, like drug pressure, that's killing all the normal parasites, and very occasionally, when millions of people are infected and there are hundreds and millions, billions of parasites in those people, some of those genetic mistakes confer resistance to that drug for a particular reason. And so even though they're very rare, these mutations that have naturally occurred in the wild, they will get selected for in a Darwinian selection. That's what natural selection is in the face of that selective force of drug pressure. And they will start to grow. And eventually, over time, they will replace the drug-sensitive form of the parasite. And this just happens over and over again. So that's how resistance emerges. It's nothing magic about it. It's just the inherent property of copying DNA that is error-prone combined with the selective force of drug pressure to allow these rare mutants that are resistant to grow up.
Aside from your research, the other big news, I suppose, in malaria at the moment is drug resistance. As has been pointed out, it seems to be tracked along the borders of Myanmar and Thailand. It's been noticed there. How is drug resistance tracked? Who's doing it, and how do you do it on a population basis?
Oh, that's a terrific question, and you know, in artemisinin in particular, it's been a real problem because the genetic basis of artemisinin resistance, as I've just described, you know, there'll be mutations in the genome of the parasite that are conferring this resistance, but the genetic basis has not been known. And so it's not been possible until very recently to track artemisinin resistance in the very simple way of looking at isolates, at the genome of isolates. And so it's had to be tracked by a consortium of governments and scientific groups from around the world in a very laborious way, looking at the time taken to clearance in a patient. So when a patient is given drugs, clearance normally happens very rapidly for parasites in the bloodstream if those parasites are sensitive. But if a person has a resistant parasite, then there's a delayed time to clearance. It might, instead of taking one day to clear, it might take 3 or 4 days to clear. Now, that's a very laborious way to track drug resistance, but that is how it's happened for the last 5 or 6 years until very recently, where the genetic basis of artemisinin is beginning to be understood and we think from now on we will have a molecular tool to be able to much more easily track it. And it's super important, as your question implies, to track artemisinin resistance. So, containment measures can be put into those areas, no matter how poor or remote and difficult the setting might be, to limit the spread and to identify why those regions have more resistance than others, and to hopefully eliminate those reasons as well. Because that sort of activity will give the artemisinin-based drugs a much longer life than would otherwise be the case if surveillance wasn't done.
You mentioned earlier also that great steps in drugs have been made in the last 50 or 60 years in terms of anti-malarials. How quickly have the parasites become resistant to the drugs used? I guess in that sense, how long is the lifespan of one form of medication before we have to trot out the next?
Another terrific question, because the answer is it's completely different depending on the drug. Some drugs, the so-called sulfur compounds, where a lot of listeners would have heard of sulfadoxine or fansidar as the trade name of the drug was known, absolutely terrific anti-malarial, but resistance emerges to that drug very, very quickly. And once we understand the genetic basis of that, we go, oh, yes, we can see why resistance has emerged very quickly. Chloroquine, on the other hand, took a lot longer, decades, to have resistance to that drug instead of a matter of years as it was for the sulfur drug. So you can't, with any great precision, predict how long a drug is going to last for before resistance will emerge. What we do know, as I was suggesting before, is that with done in the right way, particularly treatment as combination therapy, and we know this, for example, from the HIV world, where antiretroviral therapy is very successful now. It's very successful not only because they're good drugs, but because everyone's always given a cocktail of two, three or four drugs, depending on where they are, meaning resistance is much, much less likely. In malaria, we've learnt that lesson too, and even people now get artemisinin-based combination therapy with other drugs to make it much less likely that resistance will emerge. But still, resistance will emerge, and we'll need to do something about it in some time frame. As it turns out, artemisinin has lasted quite well, and we think with careful management we'll have a little bit longer to run. But you can't predict from day one how long a drug's going to last for, unfortunately.
I'm speaking today over the phone to Professor Brendan Crabb, microbiologist and a researcher who was recently involved in a groundbreaking piece of research on malarial drugs. Coming up, we learn a little bit more about that on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Joining me over the phone today is Professor Brendan Crabb, microbiologist and researcher. We're discussing a recent breakthrough in malaria drugs. So as mentioned, Professor Crabb, you were part of a group of researchers who discovered how to starve the malaria parasite of nutrients. Could you explain how this works?
Sure. Look, the malaria parasite lives inside a red blood cell, as we were saying earlier. And that's a good thing, because it likes the food inside the red blood cell, but it doesn't get everything it wants from the red blood cell itself. And it has to take in nutrients from the outside. It also has to get rid of the waste products it produces. And so one of the ways it does this is to export a lot of the proteins it produces. The malaria parasite has a big genome, codes for a lot of proteins, and it exports those out of itself into the red blood cell that it's living in and even beyond to do all of these jobs. Some of these jobs, of course, are to take up nutrients and get rid of waste so it can live. So it's been a mystery in the field as to how it exports these proteins. How does it take proteins that it makes across a few membranes out into the red blood cell cytosol? It was thought that there must be a particular gateway for this to happen. We knew that hundreds of different parasite proteins went across this, these membranes. We didn't know how it was done. And so the field of malariologists around the world were very interested in discovering this, because not only a very interesting part of the biology of the parasite, but we understood that it was a especially vulnerable point in the parasite's life cycle. Here was a part of the parasite's machinery that interconnected hundreds of different functions in the one system, you know, and that is because here was a, you know, hundreds of different parasite proteins that all had to get through this same gateway. So everyone wanted to find this gateway, and really the discovery we made was that protein or protein complex that allows proteins to be exported from one side to the other. And so the theory then is, or more than theory, is that if you interfere with the function, as we demonstrated, of that gateway, you block all of these different exported proteins from getting out. And given that they're involved in nutrient uptake, the parasite dies very quickly of starvation.
The gene involved with this is the PTEX gene. How did you discover that particular gene? How was it identified?
Well, the gene for PTX, or PTEX as we call it, encodes a protein complex. There's a bunch of genes, which is the PTEX protein complex. And look, effectively, it was a long, slow process. 5 years ago, we published work to say we found a number of genes encoding proteins that had the characteristics of this gateway, or translocon as we call it. And we then took us 5 years to develop experimental techniques to prove that, you know. And what those experimental techniques were to do something that mimicked the action of a drug, of a specific drug that would target the PTEX members. And we used genetic techniques. So these are methods that can knock the PTEX gene out, gene encoding the PTEX complex of the genome. So the malaria parasite genome has 5,200 genes in it. And this is a living parasite. And we developed methods to knock out just one of those genes. And of course, if you knock out the PTEX gene, literally delete the gene from the genome, and still have a live parasite, you ask, what happens to that parasite? And that's how we were able to see that if you delete the gene encoding this putative gateway, at that time putative gateway, the parasites not only can't export proteins anymore, which is the thing we were postulating this gateway did, it was a pathway to traffic proteins across membranes, but they die. They die very quickly of starvation. And so, you know, this genetic technique mimicked what we think a drug will do if you target the PTEX. And so we'd sort of validated that that the PTEX gene, or the gene encoding the PTEX complex, did exactly as we thought. It was a gateway, and it was a very attractive drug target.
So if I understand this correctly, this drug would probably be used for the human host as opposed to the mosquitoes. And since the parasites die so quickly, does this then mean that a person who is, I guess, technically infected with the parasite, that person would still not get sick?
Oh, not necessarily. So yes, it is for the human host only, not for the mosquito stage. It depends when you take the drug. So antimalarials can get used for treatment. So, you know, you get a fever and you go to your doctor and your doctor says you've got malaria and you're feeling sick, and you get antimalarials and you get better. So that is still a very common way in which drugs against this PTEX complex will get used. But as I think you're inferring, antimalarials can get used prophylactically, you know, to at low doses to take when you're not sick, but perhaps travelling to a malaria endemic area, if you don't live in one, you can take them as travellers do, you know, tourists do, or military personnel and so on. You can take antimalarial drugs prophylactically in that way. And then, of course, in those cases, people won't get sick. They will, as you say, technically get infected, but the parasite will be killed before they've grown up at all to be sick. So you can use anti-malarial drugs in those two different ways.
I understand that two separate groups of researchers, one from the Burnett Institute and another from Deakin University, achieved the same outcome with different methods. What were the differences?
Yeah, and we joined forces to publish that work together. That's absolutely right. My our colleagues and friends at Deakin, led by Dr. Tanya De Koning Ward, they did their work in not using human malaria, but using mouse experimental laboratory mouse malaria. Now, the advantage of the system that they used is that you could test the function of this PTEX gateway in a living animal. So they were able to repeat the work that we did in with the human malaria parasite grown in a petri dish in the laboratory. Still a live parasite, but not in the context of a live human. They were able to repeat that in a living animal. And therefore, we know from their work that parasites will die very quickly with the PTEX complex targeted in a living animal, not just in a test tube. So that's how we joined forces. And I should say a group in the US took yet another approach and we didn't publish in the same paper, but we published back-to-back in the same issue of Nature, as they had very similar results to ours, which was terrific. So we had sort of three different groups all working in different ways on this PTEX machine, and we all published together. And that's one of the reasons why it's got so much attention, because it's pretty clear now that this, whether you're in an animal or in a test tube, is a functionally very important part of the parasite that has a lot of promise as a target of drugs.
Of course, the process of translating successful research into, I guess, field action could be a long process. What would the next step for this research be?
Yeah, not could be. It will be a long process, of course. Even if things go well, it's a 5 to 10 year exercise to get it from the discovery that's been made into people. But that's okay. My earlier comments implied, we're going to need anti-malarial drugs for a long time to come. So the next step for this particular target is to work with pharmaceutical agencies who are in the drug development business to make chemical compounds that target this complex and mimic the genetic changes that we made, and then have those move through the clinical trial process. It's a very time consuming and very expensive process, but we're confident that will happen in this case because of the potency of the drug target as I've been describing. But look, it's still a long 5 to decade long process to go from a discovery like this to a drug that's in the clinic. All I can say for certain is we're still going to have hundreds of millions of malaria cases a year in 10 years' time, sadly, and be needing new drugs. So we need this pipeline of compounds to keep coming along.
How would the drugs developed from this be significantly different from conventional pharmaceuticals currently being used to treat malaria?
Well, that's a good question too. Look, each of the drugs that's been developed have different modes of action. As I've implied, here are drugs targeting this complex, this PTEX complex. It's a gateway. Well, none of the other drugs, available drugs, target that. They all do different things, targeting different proteins in the parasite, different biological processes. So, and the resistance that emerges to those drugs normally relates to the unique function, mechanism of action of those drugs. So every time you make a new drug against a new target, you probably have something that gets around the resistance. That's not 100% always the case, but it usually is the case. And given the PTEX complex is so different to any of the other targets, it's very, very likely to be quite distinct and to get around the existing resistance.
Are you concerned at all that in the 5 to 10 years taken to possibly develop a medication, that some other mutation might occur in the parasite and would change the nature of what we're doing all over again?
No, not concerned about that with respect to drugs against this. As I said earlier, mutations happen all the time, but if there's no selective force specifically driving those parasites to succeed, you know, those resistant parasites, then you won't see that as a problem specifically. We will see resistant parasites emerge to other drugs, but the likelihood of them being resistant, you know, leading to resistance to drugs against PTECs that haven't been, you know, used in people before is very unlikely. So it's not a serious concern at the moment.
What would be the cost of bringing this drug to the market? I mean, this is always a concern, especially with a disease as widespread as malaria in developing and poor countries.
Look, the scary figure, the average cost from discovery to market of any pharmaceutical compound, any new one, is about $500-600 million. A very substantial amount of money.
That is
of course,
very
not
scary
in, not
indeed.
In one hit. Yeah, it's, and that's what it costs now, and that's whether it's a drug against sort of disease of poverty or not. It costs that much because that's what's involved in the to make sure that drugs are both efficacious and safe. The return for the pharmaceutical agency on that investment is normally there, which is why they bother to do it. And we think in the case of malaria, there will be a return that makes it worthwhile. And you don't do it in one hit. You know, it's a process, and you see, in the early stages of preclinical and clinical development, whether there's been some success, and it justifies greater expenditure until you get to a big clinical trial, which is a phase 3 clinical trial, which is where most of the expense is, but you're already relatively confident it's going to work by then. But it's a very serious amount of money, and unfortunately it's just the way it is to make sure that the drugs that we receive are safe and effective, and that's just unfortunately the way it is. There's a very serious amount of money, obviously.
So with the investment involved then, would it make logistical and economic sense for it to have a mass application in the regions in which malaria is endemic?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And in the case of malaria, in the case of any disease that affects largely the developing world, there have to be creative ways to both financing and distributing those pharmaceutical agents or indeed vaccines. And, you know, in the last decade, there's been tremendous progress in that regard through agencies such as the Global Fund to Fight HIV, TB and Malaria, through the Gates Foundation, through other bodies like those, the Clinton Foundation, for example. There have been really innovative partnerships between governments, between big pharma and the development agencies of the world to both finance and to deliver vaccines and drugs to the developing world. So we're not just relying on, you know, the profit that a company can earn to drive their involvement. There are other ways now that are pretty well-trodden paths that mean I certainly have confidence that new antimalarial drugs, for example, will get developed when there's exciting pathways such as this one that are demonstrated. Unfortunately, that's not the case for all diseases of the developing world, but in the case of malaria, which is so big, the chances of everybody getting together to make sure we get new solutions are pretty high.
And with any infectious disease, really, a vaccine is always considered the holy grail. Would the creation of a potent drug based on this research negate the need for a malarial vaccine, or is it really too soon to say that?
Yeah, no, it wouldn't. It's not too soon. It would not replace the need for a vaccine. You know, for a long period of time, we're going to need new drugs. and that's because people are going to get sick of malaria. They're especially going to get sick from malaria now that we don't have that magic bullet public health vaccine. We don't have a malaria vaccine. We desperately want one. I'm pretty confident we will, in the coming few years, have a vaccine on the market. If not in the next few years, then, in years to come, we will have a malaria vaccine. But even then, we'll still have malaria. We'll still need people to be treated. So you do need both, but we desperately need the vaccine. And to, in my own opinion, to really turn this huge human misery around, just the cost of malaria to humanity has been just so enormous and still remains that way. To really turn that around, we do need a vaccine. And in no way does having new drugs negate that. It obviously helps the situation a lot, but it doesn't negate the need for a vaccine.
Might the principles behind this research have application with diseases other than malaria?
The principles, the broad principles, yes. You know, you can when you're looking to make a new drug, you're looking to validate biological processes as being good targets for drugs. And so the thoughts and ideas that led to us discovering what we thought this was 5 years ago and now what we know it is today, in broad principle terms, are relevant to making a drug to any infectious organism. But the specifics of what we discovered are very particular to malaria. And, the PTEX machine is only present in malaria parasites. And so, the drugs that will target it are only relevant to this particular organism.
And finally, what message would you like to leave us with on malaria and the future of the war we keep fighting against it?
Well, look, the malaria is a disease that, unless you live in a malaria endemic area, I think you sense that the world is on top of it and that we're making great progress and that it's not so significant anymore. And so I want to leave everyone with the message that it is true there's been tremendous progress made. The malaria control methods are working, and the rates of infection and death are now about half than they were even 10 years ago. So that's tremendous. But the reality is it's still one of the world's worst infectious diseases. Around 200 to 300 million people get sick from malaria every single year. 200 to 300 million, that's a lot of people. And around 500,000, mostly young children, die of malaria. It's a major cause of death, disability, of economic and social disadvantage. It drives poverty. So we cannot for one moment drop our guard with malaria and think that we've somehow got it solved. We can celebrate the success, but we have not got it solved. We need to remain vigilant as a global community and determined to find the solutions to rid the world of, one of its worst ever scourges.
Thank you very much, Professor. I've been speaking to Professor Brendan Crabb, microbiologist and researcher. We've been discussing a recent breakthrough in malaria drugs on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.